Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 7 of the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. We've got Parv and Karan Nagpal in the comments. So hello to you guys as well. And we've got a lot to talk about today. So let's start with India versus England. So India did win the final test match in Dharamshala quite comprehensively by an innings and 64 runs. So absolutely hammered England. And ended up winning the series with a margin of 4-1. So, Bazball has been defeated, Jared. And even though when the series started, England won a test and we got all excited. And then they had a couple of chances to maybe win another. But then it's ended pretty much how we expected it to end, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting that Brendan McCullum kind of, it was his first sort of cold cup of coffee, right? And he kind of talked about how it had happened. Because, you know, I've kind of hinted at this before, but there were certainly people within the English set up who thought it was laughable that they were going to go to India and win. Hmm. And when they won that first test, I think, and to be fair, Stokes and McCullum did believe. And when they won that first test, I do think there was an element of everyone jumping on board and being like, yeah, this must work. And by the end, McCullum is the one going, yeah, maybe we weren't smart enough here and everything else. And it's the sort of stuff all of us have been talking about.
Yeah.
It's like there are definitely people who just want to say that Bazball never works, right? Which is just, I don't know. Good luck to all of them. And there's some very smart people saying it. The numbers don't make any sense to me when you look at it. It has worked. They were a terrible team. They became a fairly decent team, but it was always going to be inconsistent because of how many risks they would take. I think that's all fair.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is that we keep saying, what, during the Ashes and the New Zealand series and now through this series of, why get yourself into a good position and then just like stuff it up for the sake of the narrative, right? We are entertainers. Well, you know, at a certain point, you also have to win. And I'm not saying you can't be both, but I don't think you have to sacrifice winning in order to entertain. I mean, say what you want about England. They are the most entertaining cricket team in Test cricket at the moment by a long distance. If they were 20% less entertaining and they won, you know, 18% more, they'd be a really, really cool team, right? Like, no one would be like, oh, they're not in it. They're really boring now. They're still pretty out there. So it's interesting that side of it. And if you go through all my stuff in the Ashes, it's what I just kept talking about again and again of like, stop believing the hype and start working out what bit works for you and what bit doesn't work for you. And it feels like now they're closer to that than ever before. But I also get the other side. I get that whole idea of, you know, the cigar mantras and all that sort of stuff, because you're trying to make flawed cricketers go up against the best players in the world. And, you know, when you're playing India or in Australia, you kind of have to pump them up, right? Like, I get that, but why don't we pump them up and be smart at the same time? That McCullum's not a dumb, was not a dumb cricketer, right? He was a really, really smart cricketer. And I think if they'd focus more on the things that made sense, rather than we're the reason the Jaiswal has made runs. And we, you know, morally, I think you could say we're ahead. No, shut the fuck up. just be honest and go, we lost that test in Edgbaston. We should have won it. We lost that test in New Zealand. We should have won it, right? And Jaiswal is fantastic. And we have to work out how to get the fucker out, not talk about how we've inspired him.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first time ever, I've heard those sort of statements now after losing 4-1 that Ben Stokes has said that, okay, you know what? After 5 test matches, we're man enough to say that the better team won. I haven't heard that from the Baz bowlers yet. So I do believe, to your point, that, you know, we've gone through one entire cycle of Bazball. They've gone with the whole dogmatic sort of mindset that we are the be-all and end-all and entertainment over results and all of that stuff. But after that one entire cycle, they've realized that, okay, we drew a series at home versus Australia and couldn't retain the Ashes. And we got, you know, pounded in India. So now...
And drew the series in New Zealand, they should have won.
And drew the series in New Zealand, they should have won. Exactly. So now in that next cycle of Bazball that we'll definitely get, because they've done enough not to lose their jobs over here. And I do still think, like you, that there are elements of Bazball that really do work. And it's good for them. And they've won more than they've won before, right?
It was really funny to me that by the fourth test, the Indian fans were like completely shitting on Bazball. And I was like, without betraying confidences, people inside the Indian camp in their first two tests were shook, right? Rahul Dravid was like going around to his batters going, we've got to sweep more. Yeah. No, you don't. just play the way you play. You don't have to sweep more, right? You know, there were all these little things happening that they were upset about. And look at Ashwin when he had that press conference. He's like, I think this game is equal, even. No, it's not. You're over 200 runs in front. Like, it's not equal. It will take them a really good batting to get to your score, let alone in front of your score, which is what they need to do in this kind of test. So it did shake them a little bit. I think it's easier. I think it's a little bit easier to get to a point where when you've lost, you can be a bit more honest. And so for me as an analyst, the worst situations for me was when our team won, right? And I knew we'd not done particularly well. Right. So I think the one that I remember is my only year at Melbourne Stars, when we shouldn't have made the finals, but there was a game where two teams had shared the points because the lights had gone out. So we sneaked our way into fourth, right? We then had a really good strategy against Hobart. We beat Hobart. We got to the final. We probably should have won the final, right? And I wrote this big report going, yeah, but we also, like, we everyone's going to say we should have won the final. They're forgetting that for us this season, we were pretty inconsistent and we just scraped our way in anyway. There's a lot of things that need to be fixed here. That's not what they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
They wanted to hear, what are the slight tweaks we need to make? Whereas I was like, I still think there's some fundamental things that we need to get back and start. And I think the drawn series, especially the, you know, if you think about those two drawn series we just mentioned, New Zealand and Australia, they should have won both of those probably. I would argue, having covered both of those series, they were probably pound for pound all the way through the series, the better team. Right? Now, that doesn't mean that Australia didn't deserve to be in the position they were in, because they stole the moments from England when it mattered. And New Zealand, incredible comeback from New Zealand to win that other test match. But England were probably the better team. So maybe at that stage, it's hard for them to go, how do we distill this a little bit? But the other side is that it's funny now that all I get is comments about the especially Indian fans at the moment, but also, you know, Pakistani and Australian fans and South African fans go, oh, the English media is just hyping up the team. The English media is absolutely famous for slandering their team.
Yeah.
Okay. Throughout the history of cricket, right? They put the foot in. They're so much more independent than, I mean, I grew up in Australia. Australian media, I've never seen, is particularly independent. I'd say it's almost a wing of the cricket team at certain times, right? And the England media can be that. They can also be the complete opposite, and they can do that for years or decades if they have to, right? I think a lot of the McCullumness of it and the Stokes, that sort of confidence and everything else came from, we have to kind of just, this may not work. They knew it wouldn't work consistently. They were, if we're being honest, I think if you listen to some of the things that McCullum, I think, specifically said, he was like, even he was surprised they were winning as much as they were when they first started this, right? But they had to portray that confidence a little bit, because they were trying to pump up what is a flawed bunch of players. If it wasn't a flawed bunch of players, they wouldn't have had to bowl Joe Root to death, right?
That's true.
If it wasn't a flawed bunch of players, they would have picked two kids who almost never bowled in first-class cricket before and said, good luck! Right? Like, and another guy who played one test, he's not even sure if he's a batter or a bowler, was like one of their frontline spinners at one stage. But Ollie Robertson, of like, do we even play Ollie Robertson? Yeah. Is this like, you know, where are we with this?
Well, we'll keep him around to write stuff about us.
Yeah, maybe he's our PR agent or our anti-PR agent. I'm not sure. So the point being is that I do think there was a lot of nonsense. And I said this before, when people were like, I can't believe England have said this at this press conference. They weren't really saying it for the press. Because they knew that a lot of it would be, that's what the England press do. There's what, 9 different newspapers in England. They all get the same quotes, and they all go, you know, they all go in different directions with the exact same quotes. When the England team was talking, they were talking for the change room.
Yeah.
And that is a very different thing that we don't see a lot of in cricket. And I thought that was a really, really interesting way of doing it. But there was also, as you and I know, complete and utter batshit things that were said. Yeah. Right? And if they've got past that, that's a positive.
I mean, when I look at Bazball Iteration 1, which has just completed, it started off with, you know, 11 victories out of 12. That was what the number looked like once upon a time, I remember. And from a scale of like conventional to batshit crazy left field, they were on this side of the spectrum, batshit crazy left field. I feel in Iteration 2, if they can land somewhere 75% towards batshit type, you know, crazy left field, I think that's where maybe the magic will be at. But we'll, of course, know with time how that, comes about and whether or not Bazball survives and what it evolves into. Anyway, let's come to India. And 16 of the 20 English wickets that fell in Dharamshala, which is generally, you know, thought of as a place where pace bowlers do well, if I'm not wrong. Those wickets fell to Ashwin and Kuldeep. And, you know, let's talk about Kuldeep first, because England's first innings collapsed. They were going quite well. They were, what, 100 for two. And Kuldeep kind of removed five of their top six batters and ended up with 5 for 72. And I think after this test match and after the series, for me at least, Kuldeep Yadav has established himself as a test match regular in their home tests, at least, India's.
Yeah, I thought by the end of the series, he was bowling even better than he was at the start. I thought he, you know, he moved forward. He was more in control of the way he bowled. He was more confident. You know, early on, England tried to knock him out of the attack. By the end, they didn't even look like that was an option for them, right? That's how much he developed confidence and, you know, his ability to land the ball where he wanted and everything else. It's a complicating, in India, it's perfect, right? You just play Ashwin, Jadeja and Kuldeep, Bumrah, and whichever other person wants to bowl six overs of seam for you, right? Absolutely fine. It does get more complicated when they travel overseas and they want to play a five-person attack. And, you know, and once they get into that five-person attack, like, if you don't pick Ashwin, you're then got a very, very skinny number eight. And I know a lot of people are very excited about how Kuldeep's batted at times in this series. That's going to be tested in, you know, playing in Australia, right? Like, he got bounced out by Jimmy Anderson.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just saying, Australian pitches are a little bit faster than up north in India, and the Australian bowlers are a little bit faster than Jimmy Anderson.
And you'll know that Ashwin is someone who will just wear it on his body, you know?
Yeah, and it's a fair point as well. It's not that we think Ashwin's not going to get bounced out or not going to get hit or anything, but the point being that Kuldeep has to go through all that sort of stuff. He has to learn it. He has to, you know, and everything else. Also, I think I see him as a really, really good number nine, like a Jason Gillespie, Matthew Hoggard, with slightly more shots than those two. But that kind of number nine where he can kind of stick in. At number eight, he's a little bit more exposed in that situation. Does that mean that, you know, Lord Tucker comes back in or you know, whatever that variation is, we have to work out. But it does complicate things a little bit more on the road. But in India, this is absolutely perfect. Right,
I mean,
you've got Jadeja, Ashwin, and Kuldeep. It could not work any more perfectly for them at home. And they had Akshar before, and he was pretty good.
Yeah, I would just be tempted to play Kuldeep in Sydney. Otherwise, I think he doesn't warrant a spot overseas or in Senna Nations just yet. But in Sydney, I might be tempted.
Oh, I don't know. I just think in Australia, if he can't pick his wrong end, I think he's all. We just saw England players all the way through the series. And you're talking about Ben Stokes and Bairstow, right? So you're talking about guys who've played a lot of international cricket. Not pick his wrong in the fifth test.
Yeah.
And wrist spinners in Australia are usually more of a threat than finger spinners. So I know what you're saying. I get the overall point of what you're saying. But I the way he's bowling at the moment, and I've seen him bowl against Australia on a week up north as well. In Dharamshala back whenever it was, when he wasn't anywhere near this bowler. I think he's still got a real place in Australia. But I think you're also right. I'm not sure they can play him in every test. And I do think that is part of the issue going forward and how it works for them.
Absolutely. And of course, time will unfold how India's 11 kind of you know, shapes up across different conditions. But in home tests, I think both of us are in agreement that Kuldeep definitely plays now. We've got some more people who've joined us in the comments. We had Pav and Karan Nagpal earlier. We've got Akira, AZN Fratboy 1, Mookie, Shivam Chaudhary, who has caught the live show for the first time. So, welcome. And let's talk about Ravi Ashwin now. Of course, he took 9 wickets in this game, 4 in the first innings and 5 in the second. And, you know, Ashwin wasn't performing at peak levels in this series, had a bit of a family emergency as well, came back, you know, struck gold. And in this test match, we finally saw that Ashwin of old because he was just unstoppable.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think someone else might have put this on Twitter and me and Cheyenne are talking about it quite a bit as well, that once he started bowling with the new ball again, he looked a lot more dynamic. That's great, but it's also a bit of a concern because does that mean he doesn't quite have the snap anymore with the older, softer ball to be a constant threat that he used to be? I don't know. But the way once he got that new ball in his hand and started bowling with it regularly, England just didn't have any answers, right? Like the Ben Duckett's shot, I'll probably do a big video on this because I think it's really interesting looking at Ben Duckett's shot and the two Joe Root shots in this series of understanding why batters make such bad decisions. And, you know, baseball sort of fries your brain a little bit as well. Like if you're a batter of like, oh, I can't let him get on top of me. But he had just completely worked Ben Duckett over to a point where Ben Duckett didn't think there was another option other than just running down the wicket and hoping for the best. And that's peak Ashwin, right? When, you know, you're a left-hander and you just think there's no point me standing here because I'm just taking up space and might as well get a right-hander in and maybe they'll be able to survive an extra 20 balls. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. You know, there were people talking about whether he was past it. I still think there are signs that maybe he wasn't as sharp as he has been in previous series. And I think that's fine. But I don't think that necessarily... the other thing I would say is that Jadeja and Ashwin have been bowling on wickets where literally they just come in and the ball pings sideways. And they had to put more rotations on the ball. They had to think about things a little bit more. You know, Jadeja at times in this series got whacked around a little bit as well, right? And that's just a different situation for them. And then also just the baseball nature of you're not bowling against test batting, right? It is a different situation to be in for a top player. But he came back and was magnificent in the second part of the series.
Yeah. And I mean, initially I felt like England's plans versus India's spinners, they were on point. You know, they had completely got into their heads even, and they won that test match by playing peak baseball cricket. But then over the course of, you know, five test matches, they completely had England's number. And I mean, if 16 wickets in the last test are falling to Kuldeep and Ashwin, then clearly, you know, they came up trumps. If we talk about England's batters, you know, they haven't particularly performed well, barring Zach Crawley, who once again got a score in this test match, a 79. And I think he has the most 50-plus scores in a test series in India now, ever, I think, alongside like a few more people. I'm not quite sure on this record, but there is some sort of record that he broke. And Joe Root also got some runs in this test match. He scored 84 in the third innings. But those two guys were the only two batters who crossed 50 in this entire test match. If you look at the whole series, Pope and Duckett, they did well in patches. But overall, what do you think just went wrong with England's batting as a whole?
Look, I think Duckett and Crawley got them off to great starts. I think Duckett's overall figures probably don't look as good as they should have because, you know, it's kind of one big innings. But if you think back the amount of times that, you know, the amount of times that India was shook by the partnership at the top, and he was generally the more explosive player in those. So he played a big part in that. Once Ashwin worked him out, or not even worked him out, was just allowed to bowl to him early on, it was a little bit different. So I would say Crawley and Duckett were fine. Root, my guess is, and I haven't looked at this exactly, but my guess for Root is that they bowled him into the dirt for 2.5 test matches. And then he started making runs when he didn't have to bowl all the time.
Yeah. Mark Woodcock made that point. You know, that's you're not the first person to say that. A lot of people were saying if you wanted a genuine all-rounder, why'd you pick Joe Root for that job? Because he's your premier test batter and run scorer. And on, you know, Indian surfaces, he's a good sweeper of the ball. He plays spin well. You want him to do the bulk of the scoring. And he only got, what, 2 scores at the end? Out of what?
Yeah, and one of them was when the series was over, right? That's not disrespecting the fact he had to go out there and make runs, but the series was over when he made that second score. So if I think Root, it'd be interesting to see if you played that series again and he didn't have to bowl, how many runs he would have made. Might not make any difference at all. Might just be a coincidence, but that's how it felt to me watching it. Yeah. Duckett and Crawley are fine. Pope is what we thought he was, right? Like he managed in one test to get away with it and play a high risk game that really worked for him. And then he never did. And the other problem with Pope is I think he's a nervous starter and he's terrible at starting against two spinners. So you're kind of combining the two things he's not very good at all together.
Yeah.
And so someone, I can't remember, maybe someone tweeted this, might've been Wagner oh my God, I've forgotten the guy's name. The New Zealand statistician who sometimes tweets things. Apologies, I can't remember your name. But he tweeted a list of players who are very, very good once they get set. And you know, it's that getting to that 25. And, you know, I sort of grew up watching Dean Jones. So, you know, he's a perfect example. And Kane Williamson is another one. And I think Ollie Pope is one of those players again. You know, Marcus North was another one. You get some of these guys who just... It's just the start. If they could get past 20, chances are you might as well, you know, back them to make 100. because they will go on and be very, very good. And Pope is that kind of player, I think. But I think it's worse in Asia because he can't play spin. He doesn't understand it. He doesn't, just not natural to him in the way that he bats. And then on top of that, usually it's the spin, I think, that's turning away from him that causes him problems. But I think Ashwin is in his head. So he's got Ashwin at one end, and he's got, what's his name? Jadeja at the other. And then in this series, by the end, he also had Kuldeep, who he couldn't pick. So there's three spinners that he all has individual issues with, right? And, you know, how he gets over this, I don't know. It's a real question mark going forward. Most of us have thought that he's not a number three. The problem is, this is the same issue that England's always had, that everyone is really five, six, seven in their team. You know, go back to the Moeen Ali, Joss Butler days where, like, literally every dude in their team could bat five, six, seven. That's absolutely great. But unfortunately, some people are going to have to bat three, right? Yeah. And that seems to be a bigger issue for them. The other guys, I thought Bairstow saw the ball fine, but this is, he's a perfect example of, like, he's still sledging when they've lost the series and he's gone out. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly lost his mind, right? Like, with all due respect to Johnny, I love the way he plays his cricket because he's got so many holes in his game and he's like, I don't care. I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to play my way. Mm-hmm. And we have seen him be absolutely magnificent at his best, right? His peak is so high and his floor is so low, right? And we know that. But, like, if you're sledging when you've lost, when you're about to lose 4-1 and you've just been dismissed and you're sledging a bloke who made 100, what are we doing here? What are we even talking about, right? Yeah. Just absolute. And, you know, he's still having to go at Gill as he's walking off the field. Like, it's just like, I don't understand it. Stokes can't play spin in Asia. Hmm. I was pretty sure of that before. I feel even more so now. I think India is a hard place, but these weren't the hardest wickets to bat on. Yep. I think, to play spin. And Ben Folkes, I think, tries really hard, but essentially Ben Folkes can't put any pressure back on anyone, right? So it's really interesting to me that by the end, Bairstow had a horror series and still averaged more than Folkes, who faced like twice as many deliveries as it. You know, so there's a lot of people who love Ben Folkes' batting. I've said for a long time it was limited. He looks really limited in this particular series. So that has been their strength, right? Hmm. The top order has been a fucking dumpster fire, right? We know that. We're aware of that. But it's been that 4, 5, 6, 7 that has carried them, even in baseball. Hmm. Even as Crawley has been good and Duckett's done well, you know, it's still been that middle order that everyone's terrified of.
Yep.
They bowled one of them to death. Another one was so convinced he had to hit every ball for six that it didn't look like he could stay out there all that long. Another one has a weakness against spin that he couldn't overcome in this particular series. Got a couple of, you know, balls that get low. But I think that's, I think if we think about Ben Stokes that way, we're being a little bit too friendly because I don't think he was playing spin particularly well, even when that wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. And then Ben Folkes unable to put the pressure back on. That's the strength that they usually have in their batting order, and all of it didn't work.
Yeah, and I think that's a fantastic point. I definitely concur. And even in, like you mentioned, the test matches in which baseball was successful, it's that middle order to lower middle order which basically won them those games for the most part. As good as Crawley and Duckett have been as an opening pair, that wasn't their secret sauce. It was the other guys. And the depth that comes with England and all of that stuff.
I think at its best so far, when that sort of baseball theory has worked, is you kind of look at Crawley and Duckett like a three-pointer, like a bunch of three-pointers in basketball or like a bunch of home runs in baseball, in that if those guys come off, you should be almost unbeatable. Right? Because you know you have the backbone behind them, but you're not really expecting them to come off. You're actually kind of expecting it not to work perfectly and then for the middle order to come in and do their work. If you look at that New Zealand series, which started this all, it was like, you know, the batting started when Bairstow came out like half the time, right? It was Root or Bairstow and then Stokes that did it. And Root, Bairstow and Stokes have all had poor series. Like Root's average is what, 40 in this series at the end? Am I 35, 40, whatever it was, that's not what we expect from Root on wickets where it wasn't ragging. If it's ragging and he'd average this, we'd all be giving him medals, but it's not. And so he didn't have the impact that he needed to have.
I think that's the main takeaway over here, that these surfaces, or at least for the most part that we've seen in this five-match test series, has not been like, you know, akin to Indian surfaces over the last half decade. This was different You know, the batters were in the game for quite a lot of it, which is why I feel like England's batters have really let them down. Coming to India's batters, of course, in this game, India scored 477, which was the only time that they batted. And everyone got a score. Rohit and Gill scored tons. Jaiswal, Padikkal and Sarfaraz, they scored half centuries. And this might have just been their most dominant performance as a unit all series.
Yeah, it was. I found it really interesting that even within that, England found a couple of times, like, had a couple of moments where they kind of tripped them up a little bit. You know, they had that those two sort of micro collapses in the middle of all that. But this is kind of how we expected India to bat against Hartley and Bashir and Mark Wood and those sorts of guys, right? Like, it was like right at the end of the series that we kind of saw it the way that it was supposed to be. And you know, Jaiswal kind of not carried them, but certainly was a huge factor in the early part of this series.
I mean, in the last few Overthrows episodes, we've been talking about his run tally. He ended with 712 runs in the series, so 250-odd below the Dawn's record. But still, that's fantastic. This kid is, what, 22, and he's already scored 1,000 test runs. And 712 runs in 5 test matches is still a fuck ton.
Equals second quickest to 1,000 test runs. There's a bunch of players, but really good players on that list. And Jaiswal's there. Obviously, Bradman's at the top of that again. But yeah, so this is kind of how I thought they should have batted in that first test when they had a chance to win it. And if you go through, probably first test, second test, fourth test, there were so many times they could have just batted England out of the game and they never managed to. And this was the time they did. But they still... And this is a credit to the thinking and the strategy of England rather than the talent of England. On pretty good batting wickets all the way through, India never got that 550 knockout kind of blow. And it does tell you, everyone's like, oh, Baz ball's failing. And it's like, we're watching a really terrible bowling attack keep India in check with incredible players, right? And maybe that's different if Virat and KL are there and you know, or Rishabh Pant. Maybe they would have got those 550 scores. But the players who came in looked pretty good. And so, you know, you look at that Shubman Gill wicket of Anderson. That's perfect baseball cricket of just like, we are just going to get in your head until this is an ego thing. Jaiswal versus Hartley. I don't know if there was any sledging involved with that. But again, Jaiswal should have made 300 in this innings, right? Like, not against Hartley, against Bashir, sorry. Like, why are you running down the wicket to that ball? You don't have to. You've been smacking him everywhere. And I think that is what England is very good at. But they have to be very good at that because, you know, by the end, Hartley looked exhausted. I mean, he's obviously not the most astute man on the top of his head as it is. But my God, he looked like his own father by the end of that series. He was so tired, so drawn out, right? Like, and he's never been in a situation like this. The same with Bashir.
Yeah.
These guys. And I just mean numbers of overs as much as anything else, like, and back to back.
I mean, Bashir bowled, 46 overs? Yes, took a fiver, but went for 170-odd runs. And that's still good because he's still just a kid. But, you know, after this India series, when are we going to see him again? Because he doesn't seem like the sort of spinner that England are going to field in home test matches as their frontline spinner. So now there's going to be this long pause in which he doesn't play any test cricket for England. And the last memories he'll have are these memories in India, in which he did all right. He was okay. And you'd have to see.
He held his own.
Yeah, he definitely held his own. But how?
That's the big question, right? Because they don't play. Because the only. Well, obviously, they'll use him if they play India again. They'll probably take him to Bangladesh. Yeah. They'll probably take him to Sri Lanka. But they're not playing those places, those teams over there for a while. So the next away series is in Asia is Pakistan.
Yes.
I don't really see him as a Pakistan. Like him and Hartley, I think, I'm not sure that either of them are accurate enough to bowl in Pakistan. Because
Leach is going to be back, hopefully. And they'll really want Leach back. You know?
So Leach will come back. It would be very, very interesting to see how all that goes. But, you know, I'm sure Hartley, because of the all-round package, might be there. But you're right. I'm not really sure how that works overall. So how do they develop him from here is a really, really interesting one.
Yeah, it's huge. And speaking of youngsters, of course, you mentioned the fact that there was no Virat Kohli in the series. KL Rahul, I think, just played the first test and then we didn't see him again. And of course, Rishabh Pant has been injured for quite a while. So this was technically depleted India. And we didn't really feel that. Yes, sure, they didn't make those 550 scores, but you know, they ultimately won the series 4-1 and dominated a couple of those test matches in which they were going to be clear winners. Shubman Gill is the final person I want to talk about before we move on from this segment. Yes, Jaiswal scored 712 runs in the series and is the leading run scorer, yada, yada, yada. Second highest run scorer with 452 runs is Shubman Gill. And I think after the second test match, was it? Everyone was calling for his head, and now he's come up trumps and, you know, is one of the first names on the team sheet because number three is pretty much the hardest place to bat for a test match batter as is. So it's been quite the turnaround, and I personally love it.
Do you know, the interesting thing for me is that Matt Henry was terrible for New Zealand in test matches for, I don't know, first 10 or 15 tests of his career. But because it's New Zealand and there's no professional full-time cricket writers who just write on cricket, you can kind of be bad on social media. Maybe there's a few people moaning about him and maybe some talk back on you know, SEN or whatever the other sports radio station was, if it still existed when Matt Henry was playing bad. But no one really noticed. But it's like, well, wait a minute. Matt Henry's incredible in this other format. We know how good he is. Surely there's going to be a regression back to him being better in test cricket. Like, we could see that the skills should translate. They're just not translating. And Shubman Gill's the exact same. You know, I was asked about that. And I could see how he could have been dropped after that second test. But I was also saying, like, he's not a normally talented player. And exactly the same of Matt Henry. You look at those records and you go, we're going to need to be in a situation where we're absolutely positive that this person has a flaw that won't work in test cricket. And I'm not talking about the fact that he struggles when the ball comes back into him a little bit, because everyone's got those sorts of basic flaws. But, you know, I mean, like a really tragic flaw. And there was nothing in Shubman Gill's game that suggested that. And I understand it. But it was very laughable to me that in this week we've seen both of those players over the last couple of weeks, I should say, both of those players absolutely explode back in, right? Matt Henry's been doing it for a little while, of course, but Shubman Gill coming back, because that's why you keep picking players like that, right? Exactly. You don't want to get into a situation as a selecting committee where you pick a player, they don't work for two test matches, then you take them out and then you bring them back in. Because I tell you what, that's just a natural variation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what they did with Rajat Pattadar to me suggests that this Indian selecting committee and Rahul Dravid and whoever else is involved, Rohit Sharma, is quite mature. Because they are like, no, we still believe in Pattadar. Right? Him failing in a couple of test matches doesn't mean anything, right? And we have seen that, you know, Pattadar's start to his career was a little bit unlucky, but, you know, you want to compare it to Marvin Adipatu or Graham Gooch or Ken Rutherford. We've seen players literally be horrendously bad at the start of their careers.
Yeah.
And so Pattadar had a little bit of bad luck and didn't do it. So if you've got Shubman Gill and he's got, what, the highest batting average in the history of ODI cricket still, does he? He must be close.
Yeah.
Anyway. And you're not going to throw him away. You're just not in a position where you're going to be able to do that. And I think that is the smarter option. That is not what fans want. Fans want their next 20-year-old prodigy to come in and make 1,000 runs in 9 matches like Jaiswal. But Jaiswal, what if Jaiswal had come in and not made any runs when he started? Kemo Roach could have worked him over in the first couple of games. He then went to South Africa and didn't look great. And maybe he got sucked in against England and kept trying to run down the wicket and slog and not make runs. That wouldn't make me really think all that much differently of Jaiswal, because I can see that the way he sees the ball, the way his feet go, the way he picks battles that he needs to do, it's clearly he's a next level talent, right? Those are the ones you don't want to stuff up.
Yeah, I mean, when you have generational talent at your disposal like Jaiswal and Shubman Gill, which, you know, as you call them, S-tier level players, you know, or youngsters, you just have to give them that sort of time. And, you know, India played Chiteshwar Pujara in that number three role for years on years on years.
Yep.
This was Shubman Gill's first year. He just got that gig when they went to West Indies, right? When Jaiswal debuted. So give this like 10 test matches and you just have to trust both the process and, you know, these players that they'll be able to crack this format and execute their skills to perfection, which now they're coming to that point where it seems like, yes, the future is now, you know? And that's why they're the two highest scorers in the series. But anyway, I think that's enough on India and England. Let's take a short break. You're watching Uncovered with Jared and Behram. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this ad. Welcome back to Overthrows. You guys are with Behram and Jared. And we've got a fair few comments. A lot of you have questions, but we have a lot to cover as well. So if you really want something answered, send us a super chat and we'll definitely take that one on. Coming to New Zealand versus Australia, Australia have won the second test at the Hagley Oval in Christchurch by 3 wickets. So this one could have gone the other way, but it hasn't. And Australia have swept the two-match series versus their trans-Tasman rivals yet again. And Jared, the last time New Zealand won a test match versus Australia was 2011 Hobart. And the last time they won versus Australia in their own backyard at home was in March 1993. And that is just astounding.
Yeah, I don't think they were a very good side in 1993 either. I think that was just at the period where the great side was breaking up.
Danny Morrison was the player of the match.
Yeah, so that was one. I think me and Danny might have talked about that test. He didn't win a lot of tests in the back half of his career, and that was certainly one of them. But I don't know what to say. It was stumps on day one. Mm. And what did they make? They made about 160. Does that sound right?
162.
They made 162, and Australia were, I want to say, about 120 for four with Lyon in as night watch, right? And I went and checked the odds, and they were 9-1 New Zealand. And I was like, well, I'm going to take some of that because that is ridiculous, right? And I knew I wasn't going to be able to watch the test, because I was working like kind of opposite hours. Mm-hmm. But I was like, that doesn't make any sense to me, those odds at all. But that's because just no one expects them to beat them, right? And the thing that no one will remember is that they're a 9-1 shot who worked their way back into incredible favoritism in this game, especially when Australia were, 77 for four overnight at the end of day three or day four, whenever it was. And yet they've still got themselves in a position where they haven't won. And, you know, it's funny, you know, McCullum is the guru of English cricket and being a guru of IPL teams and goes around the world. He didn't fix this. Mm-hmm. Right, this issue existed when he was there as well. For all the great stuff that McCullum did, it was one of the reasons that Australia thought it was hilarious when England started copying New Zealand. They were like, "But we don't lose to New Zealand. Why would you copy New Zealand?" Now, in the end, it turned out that England copying New Zealand style was pretty clever and won them a couple of World Cups. But you can understand at the time why the Australians were like, "What the hell? Why would you do this?" But I have no answer for it. What I would say is, it was a really, really good comeback. And I thought they did very, very well to get themselves into a position to win. But they didn't win, mate. Yeah. So it's the same thing over and over again, right? And it's tough, but that's just the world that they live in. They, you know, sometimes I wonder if this isn't a really good moment, because it would be hard for them to argue when talking amongst themselves that they weren't in a really good position to win this test and draw this series, right? And they'll also be in a position of being like, there's something wrong. There is clearly something wrong when we play this side that doesn't exist with other teams. And what is it? And how do we get on top of it? And I don't know if as I said before, if it's not because of the 1993 thing, it's like some of these players weren't even alive when this started, right? So I never get these multi-generational things and how they work, but it really does take someone to upset, you know, the way that they think about cricket a little bit. And if McCullum couldn't do it, I don't know who the person is going to be able to do that for them, right?
Yeah, I think that's quite candid and honest. And maybe some soul searching is required for New Zealand. Gary Stead and Tim Southee can maybe sit down and have a chat about it and maybe involve Kane in it as well. I'm not sure.
Hasn't Southee said he might be leaving? He might not captain anymore?
Yeah. And when I asked him this question, when New Zealand came to Pakistan, start of last year, I asked him, Southee, that look, you're at the back end of your career anyway, and you're in this World Test Championship cycle. So what's the plan over here? Like, what's the succession plan? How long do you continue or intend to continue captaining New Zealand in test matches? And he did not have an answer then. And now he's gone on and said this. So kind of makes sense and kind of puts everything, like it puts a dark cloud over New Zealand's test cricket, right? Because here was a team which was very consistent, had a golden generation which delivered, and now all of a sudden they're kind of falling off the rails.
So the Southee thing is really interesting from a captaining. So we know that the reason that bowlers don't captain in test cricket is largely because of the class system in England, and batters were upper class and bowlers were professionals. But the problem with having a captain in test cricket specifically who's a bowler, other than just the niggles and the injuries and they miss more games than most batters do, is the fact that when a bowler drops off, it's usually a lot faster, right? batters have a slower decline at the end of their career, and bowlers can have like a really, you know, the Jason Gillespie one is one of the most famous ones, right? Yeah. Of just being like, might be one of the best bowlers in the world. He shouldn't be playing. He looks like a third change first class bowler.
Might be one of the best bowlers in the world and is now the best night watchman in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it'd be really interesting to see if that is playing a part also in Saudi. But you're right. You know, they had that golden generation. They played brilliantly. You know, I've done whole podcasts with Jeremy Coney, you know, a few weeks ago, you know, talking about that team quite in depth and what they achieved and everything. And now it's falling apart. And we know there's talent there. You know, they've still, what, in the last couple of years, they've found Conway, Latham, no, not Latham, Blundell, Conway, Blundell, Ravindra, Mitchell.
Darryl Mitchell, yeah.
Yeah, like that's, and Jameson, you know, and Glenn Phillips is finally looking like he's maturing as well, or working his game out a little bit more as well. Like, but at the same time, that kind of core of having Southee, Wagner, Bolt, you know, I remember when Jameson came on board, and I think it was Shane Jurgensen was their bowling coach, a former Shield cricketer, who said, this is the best four-person quick bowling lineup in the world. And I just don't think we'd given even the three-man before Jameson had come in enough credit. And now that is breaking down, right? You know, Wagner is no longer there. We don't know how often Bolt will play in the future. Southee, right as we're looking at him at the moment, looks very, very tired.
Yeah.
Jameson, we don't even know how much he's going to play. Mm-hmm. And so all that batting talent's really, really handy. And it probably kept them in this game. But in the end, they needed the bowlers to finish it, didn't they?
I'll challenge you over there.
Go.
In the third innings, right, when they were batting, four of those guys in New Zealand's batting lineup, and all four, or well, at least three of those four are seasoned professionals now and regulars in the team. Tom Latham, he scored 73, I think. Kane scored a 50. Rachin Ravindra, okay, fine. He's not experienced, but he scored 82. And then Darryl Mitchell got 58 as well. Four of these guys have crossed 50, and two of them have nearly scored tons. Even if one of those guys went, you know, a bit deeper and got a big score, this was game, set, match for New Zealand. And I feel like that is a missed opportunity in the context of this game for New Zealand.
Yes, but remember that they did all that batting from 100 runs behind.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a different psychological situation. I mean, that's probably the biggest innings in this game.
Yeah.
So I find it hard to blame the batters who, and the pitch was flattening out. I mean, you're right. There were set guys who should have gone on. I thought, you know, Williamson got a really, really good ball from Cummins, you know, was late on day two, was it? But yeah, I think, you know, they certainly got themselves into a position to be able to win that. But, you know, the bowlers, what were they? 77 for five? Am I remembering my maths right?
I mean, spare a thought for Matt Henry. 9 wickets in the game, 7 for in the first innings. Was brilliant in the first test match. He actually ended with Player of the Series award. He took 17 wickets in 2 test matches and 101 runs as well with the bat. I don't think I've ever seen this, that a team gets whitewashed and their player is a Player of the Series, right? Have you? Can you think of one?
But what happened in Andy Flower series when India, all those years back? But yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But you look at this, the bowling card, and you watch, you know, the bits of, you know, I saw key sessions and quite a few of the highlights. It looked like they had a one-person bowling attack, right? And the batting got them back into the game after that original stuff up. And the batting has been an issue for a long time, but at least we know that there is, we know that Rachin Ravindra is coming through. We know Darryl Mitchell's not going to retire anytime soon. And Devon Conway was desperate to get back into that side. And maybe Glenn Phillips, evolves into what they need him to be. Who was their second best bowler in this game from what you saw?
I think, Ben Sears was good. Yeah.
Ben Sears was fine. I would say Ben Sears was fine. Ben Sears is probably, you want him to be your sixth best bowler. And I would say in this game, he's their second best bowler, right? Now, he might continue to develop, because I thought there were certainly plenty of signs that he did well. Maybe a little bit too slow overall. But, you know, he's a decent enough professional cricketer. But that's the situation that they're in at the moment. So they've gone from arguably the best three-man attack, certainly the best four-man pace attack, to Ben Sears.
And that four-man test match attack, that won them the World Test Championship, if you really think about it, right?
That's what I'm saying. So that's what they were great at. And then they had enough good batting around them, and some really great batting, of course. But, you know, Taylor and Watling and Williamson and all that, I think they've kind of you know, with Blundell and Ravindra and Mitchell and those guys, they can replicate the batting again, maybe different in a different style, but they can replicate parts of the batting. But if Jameson isn't fit and Trent Bolt doesn't play anymore and Southie has, you know, slightly slipped back, I don't know, if Kugelange in your best four bowlers, you're probably not going to take a lot of test match wickets, I wouldn't have thought. And so that's the issue I think that they have going forward.
Yeah, and Wagner Ball is also gone. There was like this, they hinted towards bringing him back for this test match, but that didn't end up happening. But anyway, you spoke about how New Zealand, you know, fought back really well in this test match. Well, they were in a position where they should have absolutely won it. Australia were five down for 80. They needed 200 more runs to win the test match. And that's where Mitch Marsh and Alex Carey, they partnered up and they scored briskly. It was, you know, classic counterattack and Marsh got 80. And of course, he's had his moments over the last year, won his medals and all of that. But Alex Carey, he remained unbeaten on 98 and he kind of took Australia over the line. And, you know, he hasn't had the year that Mitch Marsh has had. So this was an extremely important innings for him.
Yeah, it's one of those innings that might actually end up confusing Australia quite a bit. Because where's their next tour? Is it, oh my God, why they've got to go to Sri Lanka, don't they?
Yeah.
At one stage during this World Test Championship. Can you take Alex Carey to Sri Lanka with how he's played spin?
It's true.
Right? And coming into this test match, he had, what, 150 runs in seven innings, I want to say, off the top of my head?
Something like that. I remember one good innings versus Pakistan, and that might have been it in this summer.
Yeah. Australian, was that 50? I don't think that was a big score either, was it? I'm trying to remember. Maybe it was a 50.
Score. It was a clutch score, but not
a score. He's actually, the interesting thing about him is he's played some really important innings at, And I've seen this in his one-day career, and I don't think he's a particularly good white ball player, but he's played some really important innings when all things are falling apart around him. But his ability to make consistent scores, he doesn't have. So he's now smashed this score. They have to take him to Sri Lanka, and chances are he won't get a cracker again because, you know, he's got a touch of the Ollie Popes about the way he plays spin. So it's one of those situations where, I think they were going to make a move. And they were gonna get rid of him and bring someone else in. But now I would suggest that it would be very hard to drop him based on the back of that particular innings.
Absolutely.
So all credit to him, right? Like that he does that. But I do think it causes a bit of an issue, really. You know, but the other thing I would say is that sort of Travis Head, Mitch Marsh, Alex Carey triumvirate in that middle or lower middle order it's a really, really powerful thing. And the weird thing about that is it does actually kind of replicate what England had in baseball.
Yeah.
Which is that ability of if the top three or four can, negate the ball and it gets a little bit softer, it stops swinging or whatever, you've then got, you know, three guys in a row who can score really, really quickly later on. That didn't happen in this game innings, of course, because no one made any runs at the top of the order. But you can actually see that falling apart and falling into place, which is quite funny, of course, because like Australia's like, baseball's all nonsense. It's like, have you not assembled a very similar kind of baseball lineup here, guys?
Yeah.
But also all credit to Pat Cummins. What's that? The third really important or fourth really important innings batted fourth. In a long time?
Yeah, I want to say fourth. There was one was that Edgbaston test match, right?
Yeah.
Then we had that Maxwell Afghanistan game. And then,
was there one against West Indies?
I think there was one against West Indies, wasn't it? Or at least there was one in this Australian summer. I remember talking about that not too long ago. And now we have another score in which he remained not out on 32. Look, Australia still needed 59 runs to win when they lost their seventh. And Alex Carey was batting and all of that. But Pat Cummins, you know, he's come at this exact situation and sometimes even worse and just not given his wicket away. And then on top of that, he took four wickets in New Zealand's second innings as well. So he's having the time of his life, really. He is Mr. Clutch, if we're talking about clutch.
I mean, his batting in that... his wicket is probably what has kept them in the game.
Yeah.
The one of Williamson, because I think they really could have scored a big amount if that wasn't, if that doesn't happen. So, I think that's... it's very interesting. But you're right. Like, it just feels like he's batting. And it's all... Why I find this really funny is because... this has all happened after he's demoted himself.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, he's literally put Mitchell Starc up ahead of him and then found himself in a position where now he's batting in a way that he's probably batting better than Mitchell Starc.
Yeah.
But yeah, 64 not out against West Indies. That was the one we were thinking
about. That's the one, yes.
So that's four pretty, I can't remember in what situation. I'm just having a look at the scorecard there. Well, yeah, so
all,
they were,
all in half
they were massively out of that game, weren't they? That's right. They were behind. They were 161 for seven, chasing 311 when he came in that game. Mm. And he made 64 not out, which allowed them to get into a position to eventually lose that game, but almost win that game, of course. But yeah, just it's miraculous what he's been able to do with the bat. And look, I've written about his batting so much because I've always been fascinated with it. And I remember talking to him when he was 21, 22. I can't remember what year it was, but it was when we were making the documentary and like we interviewed him for an hour, but then I just chatted to him for a while. He's because just a good guy to talk cricket to. He was really young and he's probably excited. No one had asked to interview him in a while because he wasn't quite the flavor of the month because he was about 2 years out of the Australian side.
Yeah.
And he was just talking about how much he worked on his batting. And I remember him batting at number six in a game for the Sydney Thunder, and they were trying to make him into a number six. Hmm. He does have a lot of basic batting talent available to him. And we see this sometimes when people become captains.
Mm.
You know, I call it, you know, the best three examples of this are Heath Streak, Imran Khan, and Daniel Vittori. Of like, you become a captain and you just instantly become a little bit better of a batter just because, like, suddenly they're, it means a little bit more to you when you go out to bat than it did beforehand. And those other three guys we talked about, you know, Heath Streak kind of on the verge of being an all-rounder. The other two, obviously, definitely all-rounders. But there was a bump there. And I remember Emil Dacey, when we were doing this years ago, was saying that the trend that both of us saw was that bowling captains usually got better with the bat when they took over. And the bigger reason for that is just because they probably had to take it seriously. Mm. And Pat Cummins seems to be following, you know, that pattern.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, Pat Cummins in a lot of these innings that we've mentioned has been like, you know, a perennial blocker. And he's just put a really high price on his wicket and not thrown it away. Whereas the Pat Cummins we knew with the bat prior to him being captain was someone who would have a slog and hit a few big ones, right? So it's that evolution that I really enjoy. And I do think there's a lot of truth to this notion that having that extra responsibility as captain is the reason why these knocks are coming out. So good on him. Fantastic job. But I do think that in this last, you know, little bit, let's say since they've won the World Test Championship, I don't think Pat Cummins has been their best pacer. I believe that's been Josh Hazlewood. He's been getting wickets in heaps. And this innings as well, or the first innings in this test match, he got that fifer that derailed New Zealand, right? And ultimately, if you look at this entire test combined, if Australia hadn't gotten New Zealand out on 162 odd, well, then the result might have been different. So credit to the Hoff, who, you know, it's throughout like the last half decade or so, ever since these guys have been bowling together, when you take their names, you always go like Starc, Cummins, Hazlewood, or Cummins, Hazlewood, Starc. And all of a sudden, Josh Hazlewood is performing better than both of those guys. And I think that's a massive compliment.
Do you know, he spent a couple of years trying to get better at white ball cricket, and he did it off his own back. Cricket Australia didn't really want him to. They didn't pick him for a World Cup at one stage, and all sorts of things were going on. But I think he thought for his bank balance as much as anything, and you know, he wanted to go off and do it. And I do think there was a slight regression in his red ball cricket around that period, which makes sense. He wasn't spending as much time thinking about it. And I just think since then, he's worked out how to marry the two together a little bit more. Would be my guess. But yeah, he was absolutely fantastic. No doubt about that.
Yeah. All right. We've got a super chat. Soham Bhattacharya says, "Hi, Jared and Behram. Hello to you, Soham. Why do a lot of ex-players say that you can't coach express pace into a bowler? What is it about bowling fast that is biological and inherent instead of being a learnable skill?" That's a pretty good question. I'll just give it to Jared. Take it away. MRF Academy, Jared Kimber.
Behram, you bowl seam, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Would you consider yourself a fast twitch muscle fiber athlete?
I mean, when I was 13, from that period to when I was 16, I felt like I'd gotten a lot more pace, and that's probably just because I was getting old. But also, there's one thing that I felt when I was consistently bowling, like, you know, on a regular basis, as opposed to like street cricket every now and then, my clicks were better. Like I was bowling at a higher pace just because, you know, the muscle memory and everything was, you know, on song and whatever. Like,
you didn't answer my question at all.
I'm not a twitch bowler, no.
Yeah. So So if I work with Bayram, and he's just explained one thing that's really interesting there, which is when his body was settled into a rhythm and he understood bowling a little bit more and he did it regularly, he got a little bit faster, right? You can put on pace on bowlers. So Tim Southey is a perfect example of this. I thought there was a period in Tim Southey's career where he was just going to disappear because he was just so slow. And teams had worked out how to play him. And Alan Donald gave him an extra, what it was at 4 or 5 kilometers to work with. Chris Wokes put on an extra 4 or 5 kilometers. So you can make bowlers slightly faster than they used to be. And, you know, there's the Stephen Jones style. There's the Ian Ponce style. There's all these guys out there. That's their job now, right? They make money working with bowlers and saying to them, if you do these things, you can put on 4 or 5 kilometers. What you can't do is put on 10 or 15 kilometers and turn yourself from a fast medium bowler to an express fast bowler. You can maybe go from fast medium to the sort of underside of fast, right? But you can't skip a couple of levels. And that is because it is an athletic endeavor and you need to have the incredible athleticism available to you to be able to get to that level.
What about Imran? Because I remember there's stories of him changing his action altogether and that way he became a fast bowler.
So you can change your action. I would say that with Imran, it was probably more to do with the fact that he went back and played on flat decks. So there's been a couple of bowlers. So Stuart Broad's another example. Stuart Broad was a medium pacer. And became a fast bowler. Yeah. But and Darren Goff was another example, all right? So there's a couple of guys, but that was guys who were intentionally bowling within themselves because they had been taught to bowl within themselves because, you know, that was the skill that was needed. Like if you're a seamer in Yorkshire, they don't want you to bowl 90 miles an hour. They want you to bowl outswing at 82 miles an hour, right? Yeah. You know, if you're coming through the sort of lower end of county university cricket, which is where Imran Khan came through. Again, there's no reason for him to bowl 90 miles an hour. And Stuart Broad, again, was a batter who needed to bowl a little bit. They would have said to him, you're really tall, mate. Just bowl like Tom Moody or Jacob Oram. That's all we need you to be able to do. That's slightly different. The best story about that is Craig White. Do you remember the cricketer Craig White?
I think I do.
Yeah, I think he's Darren Lehman's brother-in-law, and he played for Yorkshire. And the story is he got hit in the head and came back as a fast bowler. But if you look at Craig White bowling, he had this big slingy action. So he changed his action. So if you change your action or you change your intent, you might be able to unlock again another level. But you were talking about Imran Khan, Darren Goff, Craig White, and Stuart Broad. These are already incredible athletes, right? We're not doing this with Ollie Robertson, right? Ollie Robertson is not that kind of athlete. You're not going to be able to make Ollie Robertson bowl consistently above 90 miles an hour. Perhaps if you work with him a lot, you could get him to touch 90 miles an hour. He'd never be consistently above that kind of mark because look at the kind of athlete he is. He just doesn't have that physicality within him. Now, there isn't one kind of physicality that makes you bowl fast. It's one of the really, really interesting things of fast bowling. Of you sort of had your, you know, Fidel Edwards sort of Lassith Malinga rubber type of guys, right, who bowl fast. And we've got a history of those going back in cricket. Then you have the sort of what Fred Truman, Ryan Harris sort of tank kind of guys, right? Then you have someone like Brett Lee, who, you know, just a natural athlete who could have played any kind of sport. Maybe you put someone like Jofra Archer in that kind of reign as well. There's many different kinds of athleticism. The one thing that they probably all share is fast twitch muscle fiber, which is what sprinters have, right? And if you look at the elasticity of Geoff Thompson and Shoaib Akhtar, right? And they're probably there's probably some other bowlers in that kind of style again. That athleticism that they have is what makes them bowl fast. Perhaps in Geoff Thompson's case, it was finding that slingy catapult type action, right, as well, which might have played a part in it. But realistically, you can't make someone who is, I'm trying to think. The conversation, I think you might have told me this story the other day about Wasim Akram and Kuldeep Yadav.
Yeah, I did. I was the one.
Wasim Akram took one look at Kuldeep Yadav and went, well, you were never going to bowl fast. And that is because he knew what he was looking for. And I remember talking to Roddy Eswick.
The story, actually, yeah. I'm just going to repeat it for everyone who's over here, is that Kuldeep was a big fan of Wasim when he was growing up. So when he met Wasim in the KKR dressing room, he was like, when I was young, I wanted to be a fast bowler like you, a left-arm pacer. And Wasim was like, well, I'm glad that you turned to spin. Otherwise, we would have never met.
Exactly. And I remember when being with Roddy Eswick, who's obviously been West Indies coach for a long time and I think coaches of franchises and stuff, and was a great first-class bowler himself. I remember him talking to me about Obed McCoy, and everything he was talking about was athletic, right? So that is why you are in a situation where those things happen. That doesn't mean that there aren't technical things that you can get extra pace. It's, you know, you hear the fast bowlers when they commentate and go, if this guy had a braced front knee, he would bowl a little bit quicker. If this guy had a stronger front arm, he would bowl quicker. If he ran in directly rather than stuttering in his run up, those are all the things you can do to take yourself up a little bit. And maybe if you're a bowler who has like, and maybe Imran was one of these kinds of bowlers, I don't know. I know more about the other guys that we talked about before, but maybe there was a situation where Imran just had a bunch of things that were in that he kept fixing and he could get to that upper level, but he still needed the athleticism of that upper level, right? I'm quite athletic in some ways. It certainly was when I was younger. None of that athleticism came to any pace at all. Didn't matter how fast I ran in, how perfect my technique was. I can swing the ball like you would not believe. I've got a great off cutter, but it's all coming to you at about 70 kilometers an hour, no matter what I do, right? It just, I can't get any pace through the ball. There is an athleticism there that I'm sure people could have got me to be a decent medium pace bowler because of all the other skills I had, but I was never going to be a fast bowler. Whereas Jofra Archer and Mitchell Stark were wicket keepers who were throwing the ball just for fun in the nets. And it was quite clear that their athleticism was more suited towards bowling 90 miles an hour than it was taking 90 miles an hour.
Well, Soham, I hope that answers your question. We've got another super chat over here from Anish. He says, India have 50 international stadiums. Does any other country have a variety of pitches where it assists spin and fast bowling? The West Indies, maybe? Because maybe not West 50. Indies. Yeah, not 50, but they have the variety.
Yeah, West Indies has way more variety than India. Yeah. It's not even close. Because so many of those Indian wickets are not assisting seam bowling, whereas the West Indies has some of the quickest pitches in the world, some of the bounciest pitches in the world. They then have pitches with grass on them. They then have Guyana, which is like maybe the slowest, lowest surface in the world. Like the variety in the West Indies is mad. And I always thought that on top of the many different reasons the West Indies got good, it was the variety in the first class wickets that really helped, because when cricket becomes an international sport, their players were playing at home, they were playing in England, and then eventually they would play in Australia under Packer as well. They just had such an advantage over another. If you were an England player and you played counter cricket for years, you got picked to play for England. If you hadn't played England A, you probably hadn't been on many tours of playing top level cricket. And so the West Indian players, even if they skipped the county circuit or the league circuit and didn't play in the Packer series, just at home they had the option of playing in Guyana. And you know, Guyana is a Bangladesh wicket, really. Trinidad is probably more like a Sri Lankan wicket. Jamaica can be both. Mm-hmm. Well, not both. It can spin and it can help. And in those days, the main wicket. But it's when we talk about cricket, we usually talk about the first class wicket. The really interesting thing about West Indies is that even on one island, they have a multitude of different wickets available to them. They are built to be an academy system. it's a remarkable situation from that. So no, West Indies would have that. Modern day South Africa is really interesting because of global warming. A lot of their wickets have changed. So you have seaming wickets, you have slow wickets, you have spinning wickets, you have bouncing wickets, you have, you know, even paced wickets. So I'd say they'd have more variability now than India would have. I suppose the old days of Australia would have been another one, which again might have been the reason why Australia was so good, that you had proper spinning wickets, you had proper even wickets, you had pace wickets, you had grounds that swung, you had grounds that seamed. Unfortunately, in the drop-in era of Australian wickets, they've probably just become a little bit more the same. It's one reason why Australia has started using some of their outgrounds for first-class cricket more, because there is more variability in the outgrounds than there is in the main surfaces.
Yeah. Well, I think that was a fantastic question, Anish. Just before we end this segment, Jared, you mentioned how Australia have a really interesting sort of, you know, batting order now. Your top three are run accumulators, which are not particularly worried about how quickly they play. Then you've got Cameron Green as a buffer in between who could play either way. And then you've got those, you know, Mad Max, Maverick sort of batters in Travis Head and Mitchell Marsh and now Alex Carey, followed by a really long tail because Stark is no mug with the bat and Cummins is undefeated, I suppose, in a chase. But Manus was someone who was really struggling in this batting order, big time. He was really looking for a score in this Australian summer and failed you know, he couldn't get much runs at all versus both of Pakistan and the West Indies. But now, in this test match, you know, Australia were only able to post a lead of about 100 runs because Marnus scored that first innings 90. Big, big score for him, you'd have to say.
No, I think so, definitely. I mean, that's probably the innings that it's got them by in that game. As I said, I put the bet on New Zealand at 9-1 because I thought that Australia were in the game, and it was that New Zealand were massively in the game, but it was Marnus that almost kind of ended that situation and got them into position. A huge score for him. Yeah. Been averaging 30 for the last couple of years now, after averaging 60 every year before that, right? So, you know, he's now in a situation where he's got to go and do that. And we've seen Marnus and Babar Azam, two guys who kind of just, the wobble ball didn't bother them, and they, you know, they were just killing people. And a lot of those runs were at home. And also on top of that, you know, we know that Marnus had some luck with being dropped, although generally if you make a lot of runs, you have luck with being dropped, but that's a different question there. But I think teams are just a bit smarter in the way they bowl to him now. And they've, you know, they've worked him and Bubba out a little bit more, and it's up to those guys to come back. And I think with that, Marnus is, this is a really important innings, and it'll be very cool to see how he goes from there.
Yeah, would have been 100 as well, probably, if not for that Glenn Phillips, you know, screamer. One of the better catches. Yeah, but one of the better catches I've seen recently. But anyway, on that note, we'll end this segment. You guys are watching Overthrows with Jared and Bairam. We'll be back after this short break to talk about Bangladesh versus Sri Lanka. Welcome back to Overthrows. You guys are with Jared and Bairam. And before we come and talk about Bangladesh versus Sri Lanka, we've got another super chat. So let's take that quickly, Jared.
If you read it, I'll find it.
Yeah. It's by No Dogma. And he's paid us $2 Canadian. So thank you for that, No Dogma. And it's not even a question. It's just a suggestion, which we love, by the way. He liked the Crick Picks Cheaters episode. So the suggestion is to do one on umpires. Well, I'm not sure if we can do one worst umpires also. Yeah, you guys don't know things that might have happened in that Cheaters episode. But we'll definitely...
Yeah, the legal team had to take out something that Bairam said from that one. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the interesting thing about umpires is if you were actually doing worst umpires, you wouldn't know any of them, No Dogma, because they would all be the ones before the international. I mean...
Shakur Rana, people are like, number one.
Yeah. Oh, Shakur Rana. I mean, you know, Daryl Hare, I suppose he's a little bit more famous. Mm-hmm. But some of the Australian and the New Zealand umpires
were
absolutely horrendous.
David Shepherd's little skippy thing on the Nelson. That was weird.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the umpires back in the old, and to be fair to those guys as well, they would get like one or two tests a year. They were quite often paid by the cricket boards that they were working for. And it was just, it was a terrible situation to be in. Like umpires, international umpires should not be paid by local boards to begin with. And then there was no cameras and everything else. But I've said this many times before. If you want to see bad umpires, like people complain about umpiring now, I was like, you guys have no idea. Oh, go and have a look at what's his name? Bruce Reid. I don't know if Roy Belinda's clips are still up, but the Bruce Reid LBW mix or just Bruce Reid's wickets to see some of the worst umpiring decisions you will ever see. But yeah, modern umpiring, nowhere near that level. I mean, that doesn't mean we don't have, you know, Dr. Ove and Paul Rifle. Joel Wilson has struggled a little bit, you know. Alim Dar towards the end of his career, Steve Buckner towards the end of his career, and they were both very good umpires when they were younger as well. So yeah, you know, there's definitely that. But yeah, I don't know if that's a Crick Picks thing. Yeah. Maybe it is.
Maybe best umpires is a good one. You know,
it would be interesting as well. But what I would say is there was a Rudy Gobert in the NBA the other day was complaining about the referees. And in it, he said, look, we all make mistakes. And he talked about in the same game that he tried to do a dunk and he airballed a dunk. Now, I don't know how you do that when you've got like a 9-foot wingspan like he does, right? But the point is, he was trying to make is the umpires do make mistakes, or the referees do make mistakes, and the players make mistakes. And it seems to be that when an umpire makes a mistake, we focus on it a lot more. Why should they be any more accurate than or any more consistent than any other human being on the planet? They should be exactly the same. So I know how hard umpiring is, and I still think there are things that the ICC could do to make the system better, but I get it.
Yeah, no, but I do think that Billy Doctorow and Joel Wilson are actually not up to, you know, the mark when it comes to international elite level umpiring.
I just think the ICC is crap the way that they deal with all this sort of stuff. They should just tell us what the stats are and we can have a look at it ourselves. If they've got stats to prove these guys aren't as terrible as we think, then show us and shut us all up, right? Like the ICC shit me to tears. You go to them about a decision, they'll be like, Jared, you know we don't speak about decisions. And I went, you know that just means everyone's going to just badmouth you guys for days. Is that the better option here, really?
Seriously. Anyway, let's come to Sri Lanka versus Bangladesh. And Sri Lanka are touring Bangladesh currently. And the three-match T20 IS series is over. Bangladesh have lost the series by a margin of 2-1. And the first game of the series was a proper nail-biter. And Darshan Chanakar, he successfully defended 12 runs in the final over to give Sri Lanka victory by 3 runs. And for Bangladesh, it was senior pro Mahmudullah. I know you love him and he's come and scored a vital 50 again. He scored 31 ball 54. And then the newcomer, Jaquir Ali, he scored 68 off 34. I feel like Bangladesh should have won that game.
I didn't see it at all. Take me through it. I mean, my big question for you in this sort of stuff is, did we learn anything ahead of the World Cup that we need to know? The young batter coming through seems like an interesting one for me.
Yeah, but it doesn't, or well, his record doesn't really hold up. I did check it on Cricket Info and everything. So, you know, if the young batter had been prolific in the build-up to him making his debut or whatever for Bangladesh and then come and scored, I would be more excited. Because with, let's suppose, what's that guy's name? Tauhid Ridhoi. There was so much to love about Ridhoi, right? That you were like, oh, expect this guy to perform. With Jaquir Ali, I feel like it might be a flash in the pan because I want to see more evidence. And Bangladesh without Shakib feel like a depleted sort of unit to me because there was this other guy, a leg spinner, who in one game took 2 for 35 and scored like 50 off 30 or something like that. I got excited. I was like, hey, maybe they found the next Shakib. Went and checked the record and this was the best game he's ever played in his life. Right.
So, well, the Jaquir Ali one was funny because if I remember, I didn't really follow this series. I'm just sort of starting to get back into the T20 space, and I'll go and look at all the highlights and the stats afterwards. But my memory of him is that in another game he made like 4 of 17 balls or something stupid. So it is a little bit more random. What I like is that we are starting to see Bangladeshi batters come into international cricket and attack and play freely and you know, back themselves. Because I always thought that was the bigger issue. It's like the talent is one thing, but they all looked like all they could do is hit the ball to mid-off and mid-on over and over again. And it's like, that's really great, but you can't do that in international cricket. So we are seeing that side of things. Okay, you've watched this series. You've watched a little bit of this. Just a little bit. Which team do you think is going to go further in the World Cup?
I think Sri Lanka are definitely going further in the World Cup because if I look at Bangladesh, look, what were the big positives for them? Jaquir Ali, again, I personally feel it's a flash in the pan sort of situation. The Rishad Hussain guy, the spinner I was talking about, he's 21. So maybe, just maybe, there is time to develop him, right? If they have him and Mehdi in that lower middle order who are bowling 4 overs and batting quickly, I think that could be good for Bangladesh. But what I'm concerned about with respect to the Tigers is that Shanto is the captain. And as much as we love him, and as much as love as we...
Be very careful what you say.
Yeah. On Uncovered and Overthrows, we've always adored Shanto and his arc has been very closely followed. And he even got an unbeaten 53 of 38 in the second game to help them win. That's, you know, Bangladesh squaring the series right over there, courtesy of their captain. I just don't think he's the right man for the job in the shortest format because we know that he's not the most explosive batter around the block. Like, that's not his game.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they need... I don't know. I can't talk about Shanto.
Yeah.
With any kind of objective way. I do think he can get into that other gear, but you're right. He's probably more suited to the one-day game and the test match game at the moment. So, yes, you're probably right. But, you know... They do need, it's weird to say this about a 25-year-old who 2 years ago was the worst player in the world, but they probably do need a couple of grown-ups around, right, to help out. And I don't know if he'd have to be a pretty good tactical player to overcome the way he plays in T20 at the moment. I think you're probably fair there.
Yeah, and why I think Sri Lanka are on to something is because, In this series, Partham Nisanka isn't even playing. But in the last one, we saw that he was doing well. That's a good sign. The fact that Kusal Mendes has been a batter reborn since the ODI World Cup, right? I think that is their biggest plus. He scored 59 of 36 in the first game, 36 of 22 in the second, and 86 of 55 in the third. That's 250s, and the most number of runs in this entire series. Also went away with the Player of the Series award. I feel like he has shifted that gear. And, you know, this new Kusal Mendes always goes at a rate quicker than Kusal Mendes of old. Plus, there are some good batters in the Sri Lankan side. Don't get me wrong. I like Asa Lanka. And there's stuff to like about Samra Vikrama as well. But I don't see those guys being as explosive as Kusal Mendes. So I feel like he really holds the key. And if he comes good, Hasaranga comes good, and, you know, one of the seamers or another spinner comes good, then I see Sri Lanka winning games. And that, I think, is more of a complete package as a unit than what Bangladesh have.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I still think if Sri Lanka can ever get their full strength bowling lineup into a World Cup with all their seamers and their spinners, they probably just need that two or three batters to explode, right? And they could do that. I don't think they're a semi-finalist chance, but maybe they're the sort of team that can be fighting for the semi-final spots in that situation. I think that's where it's quite interesting if you look at it from that perspective. But look, I think there's something going on in Sri Lankan cricket at the moment, and that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, let's suppose Nisanka and Mendes, Kusal Mendes, they open, right? And then you've got that new kid as well, Kamindu, who was once an ambidextrous spinner but is now a batter.
I was there when he made his debut, man.
Yeah, there you go. And then, you know, Samra Vikrama might not go at that pace. You know, he's a touch slower, but he's scoring consistently. Asa Lanka's there and thereabouts, plays spin really well. I feel like in the bowling, you know, if they can restrict teams to 140, 150 odd, they'll be winning a lot in the World Cup. And, you know, they have Asa Ranga. They've got Teekshana, and Teekshana is, you know, Dhoni's guy in Chennai as well. So he'll be completely fueled for this World Cup and will have a lot of good game time under his belt. They've got a new slinger, took 5 for 20 in the final game, took a hat-trick as well, a very Malinga-esque hat-trick, if you will. And it's interesting to me how ever since we've seen Malinga, we have seen, you know, I can't even count the number of slingers that we've seen on my fingers anymore because there's always a new one around the block. And within Sri Lanka, now you have Pathirana and this Nuwan Tushara guy who did really well. I mean, 5 for 20 is solid.
You know, I think we had them a little bit in history, but they were coached out of the game by the more traditional teams. I know that there was an indigenous player whose name I'm going to forget, but it was the guy who knocked Bradman over, who I think his action was probably more like Fidel Edwards, but again, that similar kind of style. So it did exist before. And remember, at one stage of cricket, we had round arm action, right? Like this, it's not, we didn't go from underarm to overarm. We actually went from underarm to round arm. And then eventually we had a mix of round and overarm kind of bowling. So it's always been there. But I do think that sort of, and I don't know if all these guys are beach players, but certainly in Malinga's case, that sort of, it makes sense on the beach. And I remember playing a game in Gaul on the beach, and there was another game going on where really serious players were going on, and we went and had a look, and there was a guy there doing it left arm, basically bowling like Malinga, probably 75 miles an hour, just getting it through. And I was thinking, if they could get three or four of these guys every generation, they'll be doing really, really well, because you'll still produce your normal bowlers as well. So I think it's a fascinating one to go through. And, you know, the one thing that I would say about Sri Lankan cricket is they, in a way that New Zealand are very good at tactical innovation, Sri Lanka is very good at technical innovation of just like, no, we're going to do this. Whereas, you know, I remember there was an Australian bowler who wanted to bowl round arm in T20 cricket, and he did it in the nets, and everyone said it was impossible to play. And he went back to his shield team and bowled a couple to show everyone what he was doing. And the coach came up to him and said, you do that again and you will never play for us. there's a big difference in the way that some of these cultures think about technical stuff.
Yeah. No, and he is a different kind of slinger compared to Pathirana, let's say. And you know, for those of you who haven't watched that hat-trick, go and watch it, because he got, you know, two guys bowled through the gate or whatever. Or, well, slingers can never bowl anyone through the gate, but you get what I mean.
Under the gate.
Yeah. And then there was one LBW. So it was a really attractive looking hat trick. And I mean, they always get these exciting pacers. You know, Madhu Shankar was another that we saw in the ODI World Cup. I feel like Sri Lanka just need to figure out what that bowling attack needs to look like. Like, what's the first string bowling attack over here? And that might help them a lot in the T20 World Cup.
No, I think that's more than fair. I mean, you know, a lot of teams are going to have to work this out on the fly. And this is probably good conditions to do it because we assume the World Cup will be at times on similar kinds of conditions to what we're seeing now.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly for those teams who play their home cricket in Asia and in Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. You know, they should be happy that the World Cup is coming to the Caribbean. If they make it to that stage, of course, because the US will be where it'll be played initially. Anyway, that kind of wraps up Overthrows for the week. So for everyone who came in the comment section, thank you for all the interactions and for all your love. And if you like this video, like it, share it with your friends and subscribe to both this channel and Jared's other channel on YouTube. We'll be back with another episode of Overthrows next week. That'll be all for today. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.